This podcast is for general education, information, and entertainment purposes only, and is not to be used as medical advice for any particular patient. Clinicians must rely on their own informed clinical judgment in making recommendations to their patients. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the hosts and should not be interpreted to reflect the official policies or positions of any entity. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of BCR Pod. I'm Michael Fishman.
And I'm Jamie Lim. We are both senior residents in the BCRP and your hosts for this podcast.
We're going to be taking the next 15 minutes to review a few of the case-based residency conferences from the past week, a few tilts or things I learned today from our clinical shifts, and then highlight co-residents doing cool stuff towards the end.
And with that, let's get started. Now on to our In Case You Missed It. Is that what we're calling this section? I don't even remember. Part one, conferences. Monday we had no conferences. On Tuesday, our morning conference was given by Dr. Bobby Rosen, one of our chiefs. And he had a case about a newborn with undescended testicles who ended up having idiopathic hypogonadotropic hypogonadism. The pathology of this is that there's a functional absence of GnRH secretion from the hypothalamus or a defect in the GnRH action in the anterior pituitary. Epidemiologically, there is a male to female predominance of 4-1. The management is sex steroids for development of secondary sex characteristics and promotion of bone and muscle mass, as well as the administration of exogenous gonadotropin for induction of spermatogenesis in men.
But you can't say idiopathic hypogonadotropic hypogonadism 3 times.
Idiopathic hypogonadotropic. Yeah, can't even say it once.
We'll just move on to the next conference. Wednesday morning was a conference by none other than Dr. Zach Winthrop. He presented a case of a 22-year-old who had hemoglobin SC and asthma, who came in with headache and fever and was ultimately found to have AKI, thrombocytopenia, and anemia on labs, and ultimately was diagnosed with TTP, which was quite fascinating. So thrombotic thrombocytopenic purpura. And three big learning pearls that I took away from this case is the kind of classic pentad that we're taught about in medical school is fever, anemia, thrombocytopenia, renal failure, and neurologic symptoms, of which this patient ended up having the whole pentad. Some other useful tips is there's something called the plasmic score, which you can find on UpToDate or MDCalc, which is a useful scoring system to kind of predict a patient's likelihood of actually having TTP, which is really helpful because the management of TTP is quite specific. And if you are suspecting it and they're high enough risk, you should actually start Plex before you even have the definitive diagnosis, which it oftentimes takes days to come back. Further management, once confirmed, includes steroids and other forms of immunosuppression. And then Zach gave some really interesting tips kind of separately on an evidence-based medicine side on performing an LP. And a question that we always talk about is, does thrombocytopenia a contraindication? And it seems like there's actually unclear evidence both for whether it's a true contraindication and whether giving prophylactic platelet transfusion is helpful for LPs as well. So looking forward to any further research or thoughts on that. And finally, it turns out that TTP is higher risk in patients with hemoglobin SS or SC disease.
I did not know until like 2 weeks ago that Plex was plasma exchange.
The next noon conference was from Dr. Basilios, who is one of our EP physicians, and he had a whole conference on SVT or supraventricular tachycardia, which is the most common arrhythmia in children and young adults. And some major pearls that I took away from this really, really good conference were, first of all, again, your first thought should always be stable or unstable. If they're unstable, use your PALS algorithm, or maybe in the future, the BCRP pocket handbook yet to come. And if stable, really looking at that QRS complex to see if they're wide or narrow. And then you can think about regular or irregular to kind of stratify your management and diagnostic process. There was a really good conversation on different vagal maneuvers, which I found really applicable because if you're the first at the bedside, we talk about them a lot, but actually knowing what you can do is pretty helpful. So it depends on age, getting a bag of ice and putting it to the face, thinking to avoid blocking mouth and nose at the same time, unless you want respiratory arrest to be added to the problem list, is really helpful. And this is just to induce the diving reflex. A rectal temperature in infants can be helpful. Having a slightly older child who can respond to your commands, blowing into a straw or bearing down. And there's a really cool actual clinical trial. It's not a clinical trial, randomized trial called the Revert trial, which looked at a vagal maneuver of just blowing into a closed syringe followed by a passive leg raise, which actually had improved correction of SVT in adults, so something you can use for your older kids. We talked about some contraindications to adenosine, which was also really fascinating to hear about. The main ones are if a patient's having an irregular rhythm, anything that is wide complex should be something that you stop and think about and talk to a cardiologist before you push the adenosine. You also should be careful with asthma, as adenosine is also a blocker and can worsen underlying asthma. And then if a patient was a heart transplant recipient, their sympathetic innervation to their heart has been severed, so there is not a great sympathetic balance. So they can be especially sensitive, so giving a much lower dose in discussion with cardiology. And then finally, he left us with a great little rhyme that we can use as a general guide. Regular and narrow, adenosine is your hero. Irregular and wide, use procainamide.
I learned a really cool practical tip in the ED about giving adenosine, which is that, you know, that half-life of adenosine is super quick. It's within the order of seconds. And so when you push it, obviously we always learn to push it super fast and then make sure that it's followed up by a saline push. But also when you get IV access, just making sure that you have something pretty proximal is ideal, as opposed to using something like one of your hand veins.
That totally makes sense. And I remember hearing on a competitor peer podcast of ours that you really can give, I know that PALS gives specific dosing for adenosine, but unless you see kind of the flat line on the telemetry or EKG tracing, you can keep giving higher doses. Because if you don't see that, that means that it's not getting to the heart.
Right. And then on Friday, we had a morning conference. I think it was one of the best conferences ever. It was just really incredible.
Who gave it?
Looks like it was a Jamie. It was me. Just kidding. The conference was fine. It was mainly about CSF interpretation. I feel like we run into this all the time. So it was a case about a patient who came in with hard to interpret CSF, including the fact that he had a concurrent UTI. It was also a bloody tap, and it was also a pre-treated tap as well. And so I kind of went over first about how normal reference values in pediatrics are pretty different than those in adults. There's a really great paper that was published in Pediatrics a few years ago. One of the study authors was Liz Nagrovic from the Children's ED, that laid out reference ranges in pediatrics really well. The other point was that UTIs in isolation can sometimes cause a steroidopleocytosis. The study that I saw showed that 18%, or almost 1 in 5 patients with a UTI, will have a steroidopleocytosis. The third point was that you can correct for a bloody tap in infants by using the 1:1,000 ratio. The paper just found that the optimal kind of correction factor was 1:877. So, you know, for every 877 red blood cells, subtracting 1 white. But it also recognized that this was kind of a difficult number to remember. So in those greater than 29 days old, in infants greater than 29 days old, using the 1:1,000 ratio was also pretty valid. And then finally, I learned that CSF it gets sterilized by antibiotics super quickly. There was one study done a while ago that showed that for strep pneumo, there was sterilization of the CSF as quickly as 4 hours after administration of antibiotics. Although if you do have a pretreated culture or CSF sample, you know, the pleocytosis can still be helpful, because the pleocytosis is expected to persist for up to 5 to 7 days after initiation of antibiotics.
I feel like, in all seriousness, this was such a great conference, because I feel that few lab results are more stressful and difficult to interpret than CSF, and can alter a patient's course as much of, do we do a meningitis course, or is this just a rule out? And when you on the floor in the ICU are then left with the decision, do we need to tap this kid or baby? It's such a difficult decision. So I think these sets of papers and rules are actually really helpful to at least give a little bit of guidance in what is a very gray area.
Yeah, I definitely learned a ton from this one patient. All right, now on to our tilts for the week. Fish had many more than I did, so I will let him get started.
My first tilt was actually about inborn error of metabolism, which to me, few things bring my heart rate up as much when I have to think about the differential, how to manage them. And so in kind of coming across them during residency, which you'll see a lot of them on the floors, but really in the ICP and on 11 South as well, sometimes it's helpful to think backwards and think about what the major mortalities and morbidities are from. And then that way it can kind of guide your initial management and workup, obviously knowing that you'll ultimately have a metabolic specialist helping you. But main damages come from three major buckets. Those are 1, metabolic acidosis, 2, hypoglycemia, and 3, hyperammonemia. Obviously, different IEMs cause different things, but these are kind of the three major buckets. And it's important just to think about stabilizing and treating before getting that final diagnosis. And so those three buckets inform kind of my initial workup. So thinking about a VBG to help look for metabolic acidosis, a lactate as another cause of that acidosis, getting an ammonium level for hyperammonemia, checking a glucose instantly for hypoglycemia, and then among other labs, such as a comprehensive metabolic panel, ketones, et cetera.
Cool.
I can talk about one of the other tilts. I am a big proponent of activated charcoal and learning some of the indications and contraindications, as anyone who's heard my toxidrome talk can attest to. And I think this is obviously a lot of toxicology management is guided by the specialists, but there are some medications that every provider should be comfortable using. And I count among them activated charcoal and naloxone. And so for activated charcoal, the mechanism of action is that it AD adsorbs chemicals, which means it just sticks to its surface and it helps facilitate elimination and it decreases absorption. And its use, general guidelines, we always say within 1 hour, but there's not some special magical thing that happens in your digestive system at 61 minutes. So really 1 to 2 hours with adsorbable chemicals. So there's some controversy around timing, but you can use multi-dose activated charcoal for certain meds, and these will be guided by your toxicologist, but really just be aware of delayed gut motility as a side effect of meds like opioids and anticholinergics. Things that activated charcoal does not work for or non-adsorbable compounds are the corrosives, inorganic ions, heavy metals, hydrocarbons, alcohols, and contraindications for use are emesis. Charcoal is really bad if it's in your lungs, altered mental status, unprotected airway, absent bowel sounds, as it can lead to pretty bad perf and ileus as well. And then if someone needs to be scoped, charcoal will kind of deem the scope pointless. And a good dose, just to remember, is 1 gram per kilo.
I watch some mindless TV every now and then, and I was watching a cooking show where they were trying to get this ice cream to take on this like really black color. And they used apparently the recipe called for activated charcoal to make that black. I was like, that's kind of gross. And also I wonder, you know, if it was like ice creams. So, you know, does it block the absorption of all the bad stuff in ice cream? In which case, maybe that's a good thing.
I've actually come across that where I think Starbucks, some coffees do like charcoal infused drinks. And then there's like charcoal infused ice cream, which not even commenting on why you would ever destroy the beauty of ice cream with charcoal. If you're on medications, you need to be really careful about using any of these charcoal substitutes because they will decrease the absorption.
My tell for the week was about the use of tryptase in differentiating from allergic and non-allergic reactions. Recently had a patient who had a reaction to vancomycin, which included a rash, some pruritus. He was also having a little bit of like hyperventilation, which we couldn't really tell if it was kind of an anxiety component are actually part of the reaction. We had a long discussion about it, ended up talking with allergy. They said that one of the things that we could do is send off a tryptase level, which if it was very high could suggest an actual true allergic reaction as opposed to the more kind of benign vancomycin infusion reaction, which is really not an allergic reaction. It's more just a product of the vancomycin infusion rate. We ended up sending it. We actually didn't get the result back for a while, but we felt like this was much more consistent with vancomycin infusion. He was pre-treated with Benadryl and ended up doing fine with his subsequent doses of vanc.
How often we give vanc, that's such a helpful tip to avoid then putting vanc on the allergy list. I guess going to my last two tilts of this week, jumping back on the charcoal train, learning a little bit about antihistamine medication. So H1 blockers specifically, this does not account for like your H2 blockers like famotidine, ranitidine. Overdose presents with an anti-muscarinic toxidrome. So whether it's sludge or dumbbells, whatever your mnemonic for it. But there's something unique about Benadryl, which is another one of the antihistamine medications that actually does one of the more common overdoses that we need to think of, is that it has sodium and potassium channel blocking properties. So if you see Benadryl overdose, make sure to check and closely monitor EKGs, both for the QRS, which is managed with sodium bicarb, and the QTC, which actually can be hurt by sodium bicarb. So just avoiding QTC meds and making sure you maintain cardioprotective lights in any Benadryl massive overdose. And again, charcoal works for Benadryl.
You know, as everyone remembers from last week's episode, or maybe it was 2 weeks ago, with TCA overdoses, you know, the threshold for sodium bicarb with the QRS prolongation is 100 milliseconds. I wonder if that threshold like works for other overdoses or if that's specific to tricyclic antidepressants.
That's a really good question. I think it's specific to TCAs, but I would imagine if the mechanism's the same, why would it not apply to other?
Yeah, we should ask Fred Lovejoy.
Yeah, stay tuned for next episode where we figure this out. And my last tilt was I've been working on in the MICU, and we have had patients who have been on inhaled nitric oxide for pulmonary hypertension, and they've been getting daily methemoglobinemia levels on them. And I looked into it, and apparently, just like any nitrates can, nitric oxide can oxidize heme iron to the ferric state, which then causes methemoglobinemia. So if anyone's on prolonged inhaled nitric oxide, make sure you're checking that, because that can also lead to hypoxemia and issues as well.
Ferric is 2+, right?
3+.
3+. And ferrous is 2+?
Yes. Wait, let me Google that really fast. Ferric is 3+.
For our final section, we just wanted to give a shout out to Tolu, Kate, and Carl for their Wednesday afternoon resident research grand rounds. We are very excited to have a guest for this week, Dr. Kate Rosengard, who's also my neighbor, to talk about some of the research that she presented on Wednesday.
If you want to be featured on this podcast, just move in next to Jamie.
We don't play favorites here.
Okay, now we have Kate Rosengard here, who presented her wonderful research at our most recent grand rounds titled A Qualitative Study of Pediatric Resident Behaviors, Skills, and Strategies That Enhance Learning. I think the learning environment and what we do as learners is so important, as we're often considered adult learners and on our own for so much. Can you just give us a few quick pointers or big takeaways that you took from your study that we as learners can do to fully embrace our learning space?
Absolutely. And thanks for having me on the pod, guys. This is what it feels like to know that you're peaking. So I wanted to do this study because, as Fish mentioned, there's so much about the learning environment that you can't control as a trainee, and learning in residency is essentially your only job to become a qualified independent physician. And so I wanted to look at what we could control as trainees so that we could maximize our learning. And our study had some really interesting takeaways. I think the first is that there are different behaviors and skills that will allow you to learn in different ways. So we call them three different channels of learning. There's a channel where you are just learning more because you're focusing on your patient and you're, you know, going to the bedside and hearing from them. And so independent of whether you're in the best or worst learning environment, you're going to learn more. There are things that you can do for the second channel that will get others to teach you more. And then in the third channel, there are things that you can do that will get you entrusted. And then people will give you those really high fidelity learning opportunities. But to answer your actual question, the three things that we felt were the highest yield that really cut across all three of these learning channels would be to do three things as often as you can. And those three things are proposing. So put your own plans out there. Whether you're wrong or you're right, being able to put your thought process first will take you really far. And the next is questioning. Just remember that, you know, our job as trainees is to learn. So feel free to ask those questions of why are you giving me this recommendation, or why are you tweaking the plan that I just proposed that's clearly perfect already, so that you can get the most from your supervisors to get them to teach you. And the third is understanding. And I think if you just keep that in the back of your mind of, I want to understand everything I'm doing, I don't want to be an order monkey, as fun as that would be. If you try to really understand what are you doing and why are you doing this for your patient, then you really can't go wrong. My last caveat I will say is, I think, you know, the point of this study was to look at what you could control, because so often I think there's so much that we can't control, and that needs to be, frankly, many, many, many other studies. So I think these are the best things that are within our control, but I will recognize that there's a lot we need to do to fix the learning space.
Perfect. I love that. So proposing, questioning, and understanding as kind of the guiding frameworks for how we can step into that learning space. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, this has been another episode of BCR Pod. I'm Jamie Lim.
And I'm Michael Fishman. Before we sign off, any upcoming events you want to let our audience know about?
There are a few this week. First of all, a quick reminder that it's still March, which means that it's still Women's History Month. One cool thing that I thought this week that I could talk about was that, as some people know, I enjoy watching surfing. I got into it during the Olympics. I personally am a terrible surfer. I can barely stand up on the board. But the third stop of the World Championship, of the World Surf League's Championship Tour, was just taking place this past week in Portugal. And they did this really cool thing where they let the athletes kind of pick their female sport heroes and then wear their names on the back of their jerseys, including, and this was for the men and the women. Some of the athletes that were featured and picked by the surfers were Michelle Kwan, Billie Jean King, Australian tennis star Ash Barty, Skye Brown, the teenage skateboarder sensation that really killed in the Olympics last year. Bethany Hamilton, who's an American surfer who actually had her arm bitten off by a shark, but still is competing to this day at the highest levels of surfing. Japanese tennis star Naomi Osaka, Carissa Moore, one of the best female surfers of all time, and of course, Serena Williams.
Also, a quick plug for the fact that match day is coming up on March 18th. That is two Fridays from now. So we will find out who our newest class of interns that are coming to join our BCRP family will be. And also a slightly smaller, but also just as important plug that when random people burst into your room and ask you to take a short video, to please accept so we can make our match day video to welcome them to our family. And then a final plug for a wonderful conference that's coming up this week on Wednesday, the Health Equity Rounds titled Loss in Translation, Achieving Equitable Care and Outcomes for Patients with Limited English Proficiency. This is going to be run by Taylor, Sabrina, and Tom, and it's going to be such a powerful and important conference for all of us to take into our practices.
We want to thank Chris Sheston, our advisor, our future sponsors. If you're out there, our theme music is Sweet Disposition by The Temper Trap, covered by our very own Michael Fishman. And our incidental music is The Four Open Notes of a Ukulele, played by yours truly.
Thanks for joining us, and we hope you'll tune in next week for our next episode of BCR Pod.